Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, some good coronavirus news. The anticipated Labor Day spike in cases doesn't materialize in this area. In fact, cases continue to decline. More good news. Governor Cooper gives the okay for large outdoor venues to open with very limited capacity. Tom Tillis and Cal Cunningham meet in their second debate and tussle over how and when Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg should be replaced. And we experience back-to-back visits from Joe Biden and Donald Trump. Can you say battleground? Here to talk about those stories and more is WFAE reporter David Borax. Good morning, David.
Good morning, Mike.
Katie Peralta is senior editor for Charlotte Agenda. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Annie Ma is here. She's education reporter for the Charlotte Observer. Hi.
Good morning.
And Mary C. Curtis is a contributor to WCCB-TV and a columnist for Roll Call, where she is also starting a new podcast this week. I think it's already dropped, that she'll be hosting, called Equal Time. And it's available wherever podcasts are sold or are free. Is that correct?
Thank you for that, Mike, and good morning.
Welcome. Congratulations. For the first time in living memory, let us start with some good news here. Mecklenburg County Health Director Gabby Harris had feared we would experience a spike in COVID-19 cases as the result of the Labor Day holiday. We experienced a spike following Memorial Day and following July 4th, but not this time. Here's Gibby.
We're continuing to watch, but being cautiously optimistic at this point.
So good news, but can we explain it?
I think they are still maybe perhaps a little bit unclear as to exactly what's to blame or what's to credit for this cautious optimism. But you have to realize that this time around, I mean, there's a mask mandate that is pretty much being taken, I don't want to say universally seriously, but it is, you walk down the street, any crowded street here in Noda, for instance, and people wearing masks. You can't get into the grocery store without wearing a mask. Places remain in relative lockdown mode, despite the fact that we are in phase 2.5 of reopening now. So I think that it's just a level of everyone taking this very seriously, and also everyone being really sick of it. So taking it seriously for that reason, too.
Yeah, she was saying that she was being cautiously optimistic at this point. And obviously things are not getting worse. They're stabilizing or becoming better. But 28 states in the District of Columbia are seeing the reverse happen. It's going up. Is it just that there are more mask wearers and more people being socially distanced? Or do we have more things that are not fully open yet in North Carolina, and that's making the difference?
Well, you could see in states that have seen the levels drop. Remember, New York was terrible when it first started, and they are very low, I think around 1%. And scientists and others and health experts attribute that to the fact that they did take the closing down, the mask, the social distancing seriously. And we saw the head of the CDC, basically, even though he got some pushback from the administration, say that masks are the best fight against it, especially until a vaccine comes.
So the county's positivity rate, that's the number of people testing positive when tests are given, is now 5.4%. That's our lowest number to date on a rolling average, just 0.4% away from the state's target for reopening, which is 5%. And the average weekly number of people requiring hospital care has dropped to 98 for the first time since June. How does that compare? This is Mecklenburg. How does that compare to other surrounding counties in North and South Carolina? Do we know? Maybe not. Okay. So the county has been sending coronavirus ambassadors out to businesses to boost compliance with the COVID-19 regulations. And so far, we are told they have visited about 200 businesses, half of which were restaurants. Do they attribute this decline to the fact that most businesses are now in compliance?
That
unanswerable questions. I'm answering. Go ahead. I'm sorry, Katie.
I was going to say, a lot of what those ambassadors were tasked to do is to educate businesses right. on what they should be doing, not necessarily to punish them or, you know, cite them or whatever. So I think a lot of this is communicating what the state is requiring right now to certain businesses who might not have been in compliance on their own, whether that was by choice or not. For instance, you know, maintaining certain capacity, you know, 50% at restaurants, if it's, you know, requiring all staff members to wear masks, that type of thing. So I think there's, through that effort, certainly the goal was awareness. And again, it sounds like they are taking a step in the right direction with that. And it sounds like, you know, cautious optimism is certainly warranted in this.
Well, let me put this in, let me reframe the question with politics in mind. County Commission Chairman George Dunlap pleaded with county residents recently to keep wearing face masks and practice social distancing because he said it's easy for us to get comfortable because we've done better. But this is a political issue. Mask wearing particularly is a political issue. Could it be that Mecklenburg is doing better because we are an island of blue in a sea of purplish red? Mary.
Well, yes, that's part of it. You wouldn't think that mask wearing, which scientists and Dr. Fauci have said, you know, that is our main way to fight this, would be political, but it is. And you see in states with high levels, you know, I saw this scene in Florida of folks in running through a Target without masks, touching things and telling people to take off their masks. You won't see that in Mecklenburg County. Whereas, as Katie said, people do seem to be following that. So I would say that in this case, leadership does matter. And the fact that it seems like we have a Democratic governor, Roy Cooper, and he has been very strict, and you will hear some grumbling. But for the most part in Mecklenburg County, yeah, our leaders are saying do this, and people are seeing results, and they're doing it. I mean, I've even seen it. I go to the gym now, which is cautiously reopening, and people are following this to the letter.
Although we have seen some confrontations between folks who don't want to wear masks or are opposed to it and the folks who are trying to enforce it. You know, I know folks that work at restaurants and other places like that. And we've had stories on WFAE about how difficult it is right now to be the person at the front line who has to do that. And, you know, there are folks out there who are making it their duty to go in and challenge this, which makes it difficult for frontline workers.
So conditions here are improving, and in fact, they're improving around the state, enough for Governor Cooper to loosen yet another restriction, this time on larger outdoor venues. He's allowing a capacity of about 7%, which for Panther Games will mean somewhere in the neighborhood of 5,000 people in that 75,000-seat arena.
We think it's really important for these arenas to have separate entrances, to not have places where people can congregate, to make sure that only families or people who live in the same household sit together, and that there is significant social distancing and mask wearing.
Of course, that's for venues over 10,000 people outdoors, and Panther Stadium seats 75,000 or thereabouts. Will 5,000 people in the stands make a difference to revenue, to fan interest, to the games and how they're played? Will it make any difference at all? David.
Well, I for one will be glad when the TV gets rid of those fake soundtracks they've been using with the fan noise from games gone by. 5,000 fans is a lot. I think it'll make a bit of a difference. I watched a slide presentation the other day from Tom Glick, the president of the Panthers, and one of the things he showed was a picture from that game a couple of weeks ago against the Raiders, and the stadium was completely empty. It looked like not even as many people as would be at a practice, I think. And, you know, I think the coach and the players and the team are eager to have fans back in the stands.
So let me give you some exact numbers. Bank of America Stadium seats 74,687 people at 7% capacity. That means 5,240 fans will be allowed in. Any word on how the Panthers will determine who gets in?
So this is something that they have been thinking about and planning for months, because they have been really pushing elected officials to consider some sort of reopening for their facility, since it's outdoors. And since, as you said, it's actually pretty easy to socially distance when you can make sure that there are, you know, only a certain number of people in the stands. For permanent seat license holders, PSL holders, you know, back in July or something, they got the option to opt in or opt out of season tickets this year. Roughly half opted out, which, you know, seems like not as many as one might expect, given the fact that we're in the middle of a pandemic. But the team said that there is still a lot of interest in physically coming to games this year. So those who opted in will get the choice to pick like a 2-game package plus the, I think, Arizona game on October 4th. And so basically, whichever games they pick, they'll be selected based on their seniority. So however long they've been a PSL holder, you know, they'll get their preference kind of based on how long they have been.
So this will go into effect on next Friday, October the 2nd, which means the next Panther home game, I think, will have people in the stands. It's Charlotte Talks and the Local News Roundup on WFAE. Some sports teams had already received permission from the state to have small numbers of fans in the stands. I know you want to say something, David, and you can go ahead and do that, but I want to ask this question too. Why are they ahead of the game? Why were they allowed to have people in when the Panthers weren't?
I'm not sure about those other sports, but I did want to note that this also will affect NASCAR. We have a playoff race coming to Charlotte on October 11th, the Roval 400 at the Charlotte Motor Speedway. And, you know, that's a venue that has 90-something thousand seats in it. So that means about 6,600 fans will be able to go to that. You know, NASCAR was one of the first sports actually to have any fans anywhere in other states. And they've been waiting for a chance to do this in North Carolina. They've had plans that they've submitted to state officials. And so I think they're ready for this as well.
This pandemic, and we talked a little bit about this last week, has thrown some scheduling off for the Panthers and for the new Major League Soccer team. The headquarters for the Panthers being developed in Rock Hill, they're putting off that a little bit. They're also putting off some other things. The games for the Major League Soccer team have been postponed a bit. But this week, the Charlotte Football Club's president, Tom Glick, with Tepper Sports, says ticket reservations are incredible, rivaling those of Atlanta, which have been pretty healthy over the last year or two. And he's hoping for a major regional rivalry with them. At the Charlotte World Affairs Council this week, Glick outlined 4 major efforts by Tepper Sports. What were those announcements?
So it was really interesting to think about the Panthers and the Major League Soccer team as a business. You know, normally we're following it from the sports standpoint. We're looking at players and coaches and wins and losses and that sort of thing. But Tom Glick talked about having 4 lines of business. Obviously, one of them is the Panthers. One is Charlotte FC, the soccer club. Another is the venues that they own. And right now that's Bank of America Stadium. But also, as you mentioned, The Rock, their big facility they're building in Rock Hill. And then there will be a future facility out at Eastland Mall, we presume. We haven't heard much about that lately. And then the 4th line of business would be producing events. And those are the Garth Brooks and Rolling Stones concerts and things like that. And so it's really fascinating to see David Tepper's mind at work here and how he not only provides good entertainment to the area, but also thinks about it in a way that will make money for him down the line.
So I have a minute left, but I'm sorry, go ahead, Katie.
I was going to say, real quick, it's a real change from prior ownership that had one revenue stream. And if you pay $2.275 billion for an asset, you want to make sure that you make money off it.
So now I have 30 seconds left. And he said something interesting about Bank of America Stadium. He said, it's an amazing venue in a great location with a bright future ahead of it, a really bright future. What is he signaling with that comment? And the possibility of a dome. What is he signaling with that comment?
Well, you know, there are these rumors that he might try and build a new stadium west of where Bank of America Stadium is right now. But he's signaling right now that at least for the medium-term future, it looks like he will stay at Bank of America Stadium.
Okay, we got to take a break. We'll come back with more in just a moment at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Fifth Third Bank, dedicated to the financial empowerment of the community by investing time, resources, and people in the Charlotte area and throughout the state. More at 53.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. It's the Local News Roundup. I'm Mike Collins. David Borax is with us from WFAE News. Mary C. Curtis from Roll Call, WCCP TV, and her new podcast, Equal Time, which dropped this week. Katie Peralta from the Charlotte Agenda. Annie Maugh, education reporter for the Charlotte Observer. They're all with us. North Carolina U.S. Senate candidates Tom Tillis and Cal Cunningham met this week for the second of three debates. And as expected, the Supreme Court vaulted to the top of the list of topics. 4 years ago, Republican incumbent Tom Tillis said the Senate should not confirm Barack Obama's nominee, Merrick Garland, because it was too close to the election and that Congress should allow voters to decide on the next president before choosing a justice. If you recall, that was well over 200 days before the next election. We are now about 40 days away from this election, and Republicans, including Tom Tillis, are backing away from that previous position when it comes to Trump's suggestion to replace Ruth Bader Ginsburg. His answer about that, when he was asked about it at the debate, was an obfuscation.
The president took the bold step of saying, this is what I stand for, the American people can decide, based on the ones that I put on the list. Joe Biden is ducking the question. Cal Cunningham is supporting Joe Biden. We all know that they're going to be radical left judges.
So rather than answer the question, he took the opportunity to make the issue about Joe Biden rather than his fellow Republicans' hypocrisy. There is no other word for it. Meanwhile, his Democratic challenger, Cal Cunningham, had this response.
There is an important role for a United States senator as a check and balance on the president of the United States. Rather than act as a check and balance, Senator Tillis has written a blank check to the president. He has forfeited his right to independence of judgment here on behalf of the people of our state, and that's wrong.
Cunningham was referring to Tillis saying he would support the president's nominee without knowing who that nominee will be. Would such an action fall within the normally conservative interpretations of the advise and consent clause of the Constitution? Mary.
Well, you know, the thing of it is the Senate is supposed to look at each candidate, but let's see the reality of 2020, where the Republican Party is the party of Trump. And Cal Cunningham and Tom Tillis, of course, it's hypocrisy from 4 years ago, Tillis's actions, but that's where we are in 2020. And the Supreme Court, the courts in general, have usually been more of an issue for Republicans. They've run on it, that they're going to have conservative judges, and Democrats have not paid as much attention to it. But this, the death of Ruth Bader Ginsburg means that the courts are front and center. And, you know, for most candidates, it's really a base issue. If you support Trump, you want your base to get out. And Cal Cunningham is saying, no, they're not doing their duty. And it's complicated in North Carolina because we are a purple state. So
that's not answering my question. My question was, does this fall under normal conservative interpretations of the advice and consent clause in the Constitution? In other words, yes, it's the party of Trump, but they took an oath to the Constitution. Does it fall under conservative interpretation of that clause, or have they gone off the rails?
Well, he's not advising and consenting if he doesn't know who the candidate is yet that Trump will name.
And Tillis then asked Cunningham if he would support a President Biden increasing the size of the court in response to the Senate approving a new Trump justice. What was Cunningham's response to that? What did he say?
Cunningham said he doesn't support that, and he pointed out that Justice Ginsburg herself had said that 9 was the right number. So at least for the moment, that is what we're hearing from him.
So Biden has said that he has never said, to my knowledge, anything about increasing the size of the court. The Democrats are pushing for that in case this happens. Cunningham said, we need to stop injecting partisanship into our federal courts. If he wins, will he be able to stem the tide of Democratic push from leadership as a junior senator to prevent increasing the court? Would he have to cave?
Well, the Democrats have said, don't get ahead of the game. They haven't won the Senate yet. They haven't won the presidency yet. So that's what they're focused on now. But Chuck Schumer, who's the minority leader in the Senate, and others have said everything is on the table. Because if the Republicans say they lose the presidency and the Senate, and they name someone in the lame duck session, that would be a very bold move. So everything is on the table.
So what other issues came up during the second of three debates?
They talked about health care and the debate over the Affordable Care Act and what happens with that. You know, they talked about masks. There was a question about whether should there be a national mask mandate, and Tillis said no, and Cal Cunningham said no. And they also, Tillis has been hammering at Cunningham for something he said in a previous debate about vaccines. Cunningham had mentioned that he's a little skeptical of the government approval process, and he would be really careful before he got a vaccine. And Tillis has turned that into the possibility that Cunningham is an anti-vaccine person, and Cunningham was having to kind of dig himself out of that hole. So,
and did he?
I think he did partway. You know, it's a bold headline is hard to fight against when your position is somewhat nuanced as his is.
But polls have shown the American people are skeptical too.
Yeah, healthcare also surfaced, as you mentioned, David, in this, because there's a Supreme Court case that will come to the court, or a decision will be reached, or the hearing will be held just after the election. Tillis evidently incorrectly accused Cunningham of advocating for Medicare for all. Evidently, that's not true, but he does. Cunningham does advocate expansion of the Affordable Care Act. Is that correct?
Yes,
that's right.
He wants to build on it. And at a time when so many people in COVID are losing health care, the Democrats feel that's a winning issue to say that the court may strike down the Affordable Care Act.
Interestingly enough, both candidates were asked if either had smoked marijuana. and both said yes. Is this still an issue? Is it an issue in North Carolina?
Maybe their answers demonstrate to us that it's not as big an issue as it might have been once upon a time.
Well, here's the thing. In North Carolina, there are thousands of people who are arrested and locked up every single day for possession of very small amounts of marijuana. And currently in the state legislature, they're figuring out how to regulate hemp, which is not marijuana. And it's, you know, it's an interesting issue because I think as we see more and more states moving to legalize marijuana, it's more of an issue of when, not if, in North Carolina.
If you're listening to us live on Friday morning, we'll be leaving you for special coverage of services for Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, but you can continue listening on Facebook Live on WFAE's Facebook page, or you can listen tonight in the 7 o'clock hour, or tomorrow morning at 7, or the Charlotte Talks podcast when it is released later today. This is Charlotte Talks on WFAE. So President Trump has been railing for months against mail-in ballots, and this week, two Republican members of the North Carolina State Board of Elections resigned in protest, with one saying he felt misled about recent changes to absentee mail ballots that the board had approved. What is this about, David?
Proposed settlement in the court about the way that ballots are handled here, and there was several issues. One is that the settlement would make it easier for voters to correct mistakes on their ballots, including missing signatures. Voters could put their absentee ballots at special drop boxes instead of having to mail them in or hand deliver them. And the cutoff for ballots to arrive after the election was moved from November 6th to November 12th.
And so why did this cause two Republicans to resign from the Board of Elections? What about those issues made them uncomfortable?
So they're saying that this is going to make it easier for the Democrats to steal the election, to use some of their phrasing. And I think it's something that echoes what the president has been saying about, you know, trying to create uncertainty about the outcome of the election and create a situation where, you know, he now is talking about heeding what the voters say on election night.
Yeah. So,
this is part of a drumbeat of that mission from the top. Trump has said that even though he votes absentee, he wants to throw doubt into the mail-in ballots. And polls have shown that more Democrats than Republicans vote mail-in. And people are warning of a red mirage that on election night, Trump may be ahead because more Republicans vote in person and may want to then step in and say, let's not finish counting because there's something wrong with these mail-in ballots. So the Trump folks and the Republicans are going around in each of the states and making plans for this. And it was reported recently that they are actually meeting with state electors and legislators to put plans like that in place, to have folks say, to step in and want the electors to report based on not a full counting of the balance, because you know, Trump is basically saying it out loud. He's saying the quiet part out loud, that these ballots won't be valid. And he has about 40% of the American people who are also pretty much doubting it. So unless it's a big blowout, it looks like for one side or the other on election day, that we are going to be in the middle of very confusing and people with lawsuits and so forth about the presidential election.
So Republicans in our legislature are saying that Democrats are rewriting election laws while the state is witnessing a slow motion, this is a quote, slow motion mugging of North Carolina's election integrity. Who's mugging the election, Democrats or Republicans? Or both?
Well, we've seen that, North Carolina has had its election and voting laws in the courts. You remember the one that said the voter restriction went after Black voters with almost surgical precision, and they put it on the Constitution, and we have the constitutional amendment, and then we also have the voting bill that now also is in the courts on voter ID. So the argument is, do you want to expand the franchise or do you want to limit it? And Republicans say, well, we need the ID because of voter fraud. And Democrats are saying, well, studies show that there very seldom is any kind of voter fraud. And in North Carolina, actually, the one case was for Republicans.
Yes, so, and the FBI director said just this week that there is no voter fraud. There's no evidence of voter fraud, historically speaking, of any magnitude. But one of the things that this change in the election law that caused these two Republicans to resign was that mail-in ballots will now be accepted and counted 9 days beyond Election Day, which, in truth, sounds like a very long time. That would mean the state really could not be certain of the vote until, what, 9 days after November the 3rd, which makes it the 12th? Is that right?
That's how it's going to work. And it goes to the technical way that the votes are counted. It's not until that long after the election that the local boards of elections actually canvass and certify the votes. So we're going to go right up to that deadline this time. And, you know, we're already getting hints that this is going to stretch out and we may not know the results in all these elections right away. It's, you know, I would say democracy right now has got lots of question marks around it the way we're doing it.
Yeah, but it's the media's job too. I think the media has to make sure that we're reporting that we may not know the election results on election night, and that's okay, because that's the way the system works.
And some of this is so much, you know, like trying to figure out how an election during a pandemic will work. Like, yes, the ballots will be counted if they get in by November 12th, but we also have to say in the same breath that they have to be postmarked on or before election day. It's not giving people more time to vote. It's giving ballots the time they need in a delayed postal system to get in. It's like for your votes that were legitimate on election day to be legitimately counted.
Yeah. And that postal system is a very big deal right now.
Yeah, right. North Carolina is a battleground state, as we have talked about in the past, in this year's presidential election. And this week, at least for 24 hours, that was absolutely true. Charlotte became the epicenter of the presidential race.
The next president of the United States, Joe Biden.
Ladies and gentlemen, the president of the United States, Donald J. Trump.
Well, in his first appearance in the state since Super Tuesday, former Vice President Joe Biden held a socially distanced summit with Black business owners at Camp North End.
We have to break a cycle. The cycle that exists is that the African-American community, by and large, finds itself at the bottom of the economic heap when businesses and others, when things are good. When things get bad, they're the first ones in the hole. And when things get better, they're the last ones out. In addition to that, we have a criminal justice system that needs significant repair. And we're just only beginning slightly to make some progress now.
And we're talking about the election here on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. But Charlotte Agenda reported that Biden's first words when getting off the airplane were, and I quote, Donald Trump. And that was an answer to a question from a reporter who pointed out that polls here show a tight race. And he asked Biden, what gives you the sense you can win? And the answer was Donald Trump. In Charlotte, where the Democratic candidate should be spending, is Charlotte the place Joe Biden should be spending his time in North Carolina, when he really needs to convince voters in other areas?
Well, Charlotte is extremely blue, as you note. And the purpose of being here this week and, you know, for spending like 6 hours, you know, with different Black business owners in Charlotte was, I mean, first of all, to communicate that this is a battleground state and it's a very, very important one. But I think he also really wanted to address systemic racism. That's something he talked about at great length, opportunities for lifting up Black business owners. It's important to note that Black voters are very, very important to Joe Biden. They essentially saved him in South Carolina during the primaries. So I think he really wanted to meet, you know, he was there with Chris Paul, I think NBA player. He met with the Colliers, you know, the restaurant owners. It was a very, you know, well-staged event that was meant to showcase Joe Biden as a supporter of Black business owners. And I think that's the crux of it.
Yeah, well, that's my other question. He met privately at an invitation only event. Was that wise?
You know, I don't know if I could answer that question, but I think there's also something to the fact that it's going to be tough right now to hold gigantic political rallies, even as right. Donald Trump has been doing. So I think they're very reserved about their approach right now. So maybe that's part of it.
So I've maybe 30 seconds left here, but while Biden spent time at this summit of Black business owners, he told them, if you make less than $15 an hour working 40 hours a week, you are making a wage under the poverty level. No one in America should be working a 40-hour a week job and still be living in poverty. Certainly, that's nothing that they didn't already know, but did he promise to do anything to fix that?
I mean, I think he supports a living wage. In North Carolina, we still have the minimum wage of like $7.75 an hour, which is like less than half of the $15 an hour he was talking about. So, you know, it remains to be seen exactly what he would do to fix that here.
So that was on Wednesday. Less than 24 hours later, Donald Trump was in town. We'll talk about that. We'll talk about schools coming back, school sports coming back, and more when we come back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. For the local news roundup, we have gathered Annie Maugh, education reporter, who we'll be hearing from at length in just a moment when we talk about schools coming back. She's from the Charlotte Observer. Katie Peralta is here from Charlotte Agenda. Mary C. Curtis from WCCB-TV. Roll call, equal time, and more. And David Borax is here from WFAE News. You got to get a side job, David. Less than 24 hours after Joe Biden was here, Donald Trump was here. He's been here many times before this, so far this election year, most recently during his surprise visit to the Republican National Convention. But surrogates and family members have also been here a number of times. Is Biden underrepresented in the state? Is he making a mistake, Mary? Should he be sending people here?
Well, North Carolina is a must-win for Donald Trump. For Joe Biden, he doesn't have to, but really it would be great. If you had a North Carolina win, it would look like a wave. And yes, his surrogates and people are saying he needs to have more of a presence. But even in the very rallies they have, the big rallies versus the small socially distanced events, is a contrast in how they're dealing with the coronavirus. And Biden wants to say he's listening to the scientists, and Trump is saying he needs the crowds. You've seen Biden have many virtual events here, but I do think you will see more and more people from his campaign and people like Kamala Harris, who, as Katie said, the name of the game is turnout, and he needs about almost a quarter of the electorate in North Carolina is African-American. And he can have a contrast that he believes in systemic racism, and Trump has basically said he does not. So that's where he can have it. So I do think you will see more of a presence, but you won't see the big rallies.
Yeah. Yesterday's visit to Charlotte was Trump's fifth in the last 30 days. And he spoke late in the afternoon at the Duke Energy Hangar at the airport. about many things, but one of the things he talked about was his vision for health care and why he is trying to end the Affordable Care Act.
In short, we're delivering better care with more choice at a much lower cost and working to ensure Americans have access to the care they need.
So how specific did he get about what his plans are? Because he's been promising a better health care plan than Obamacare for nearly 4 years. Well, 4 years, because he promised it during the election campaign. How specific did he get?
So he laid out a plan that, as we all know, he's been trying to undermine the Affordable Care Act for years. He kind of started out by saying, I will never let the liberals take away your health care, when he's the one trying to take away the Affordable Care Act. But he basically laid out a plan that has like four pieces that comprise of things like, you know, more choices for families, more transparency, no surprise medical bills, things like that. But he also...
And pre-existing conditions would remain covered. But I'm told that some governmental experts said this would all be done until an act passes by executive order, which have no standing in law.
Exactly. So that's why a lot of people were saying last night's executive order was actually a little bit more symbolic than anything, because he promised to protect pre-existing conditions, which are already legally protected by the Affordable Care Act. So until he repeals that, or until, you know, the Supreme Court strikes that down, if that happens, you know, this is just him saying, I vow to protect these pre-existing conditions. He also kind of took his promises a step further and, you know, made some pretty lofty promises. He said that Medicare beneficiaries would receive $200 cards in the mail. For instance, he also said that...
And that's for prescription,
you know,
drugs?
Those
drugs, that the $200 card is for prescription drugs, correct?
Correct, for prescriptions. Okay. He also promised to keep fighting Big Pharma, and he... you know, also kind of made that guarantee to people with pre-existing conditions. So kind of all, you know, Joe Biden came out swinging right after that. He said, you know, this is the guy who's trying to take away your health care in the middle of a pandemic.
And he reiterated his assertion that he would protect people's Medicare and Social Security, even as he tries to eliminate the payroll tax, which supports that. If you eliminate that, there will be no Medicare and there will be no Social Security. This will be an interesting thing to watch span out over the next few weeks.
It's been interesting because healthcare and the economy are at the top of the polls. So when you see him talk about pre-existing conditions, which they're very popular and they're already in the Affordable Care Act, while the White House and the administration is there in the Supreme Court trying to strike down the Affordable Care Act, it's crazy.
You know, Donald Trump allegedly is a billionaire. We don't know that for a fact, but that's what he alleges. So do you think that Social Security and Medicare would mean nothing to him? Because a billionaire doesn't need either. So do you think he doesn't understand the connection between the payroll deduction and Medicare and Social Security? Or is this just another lie?
I'm not sure what he understands and he doesn't understand, but he might look at the polls that show him losing ground with senior citizens, because they understand.
Yeah. Okay, let's move on. We learned last week, Annie Ma from the Charlotte Observer, education reporter extraordinaire, that CMS would be returning children to the classroom using a phased-in approach, starting with younger students first, ending with high school students early next year. Remind us, when will this all begin and how does it all work?
Okay, so it will begin at the earliest October 12th with pre-K. I mean, technically it's beginning next week with children with special needs, but that has always been part of the plan. But starting October 12th, every 3 weeks, they will phase in a new group and it goes pre-K, elementary school, middle school and high school. And that means it's a long way off the older you get. And the plan is to bring in people if the metrics stay stable or continue to decline, but there's always the option of going back to remote if there is like a post-holiday spike or something.
And we're doing this because our numbers are getting better in Charlotte, Mecklenburg, and in North Carolina, but elsewhere in the country they are not. And health experts at the national level have been saying we shouldn't be sending kids to school. Are we taking a risk here?
We are. I mean, you know, that is something that Gibby Harris has emphasized from the beginning, that as soon as you open schools, there will be positive cases. And the question you should be asking is not like, how do we prevent it from happening, but what are our thresholds? What is acceptable to us? And that's kind of the question that we're asking broadly, right? Like, how many cases do we think as a society is like acceptable as like a casualty? And that's a really tough question for the school district to answer. And I think they're trying to take a measured approach, but we'll have to see, you know, like with openings, there will be cases, and that's not an inflammatory statement. It's just been true across the board.
CMS was intending to do this ABC rotational schedule before schools open, and then they reversed that decision at the last minute and decided to be all virtual. But prior to that, a lot of parents had chosen to have their children enroll in the virtual-only academy, so they would stay virtual-only until everything got to be much better. If parents who did not sign up for virtual academy are wary about sending their kids to school, is it too late to sign up for that now?
I think it depends on, you know, like CMS is not reopening those enrollments district-wide. You can contact your principal, and there are four qualifying conditions to changing your enrollment, and they include like a sudden change in childcare, a new medical diagnosis, things along those lines. I think it can be interpreted pretty broadly, and at the end of the day, it's up to your principal, and you should contact your principal.
So what sorts of safety measures do the schools have in place from the school bus on as students begin to return?
Well, masks will be required. There will be the standard symptom screenings. Kids will have to, before they can get on the bus, they will have to fill out a form saying that they have not had symptoms in the past 24 hours. But
every day
that they're in class. But you know, there's also this problem of you don't want to like abandon a child at the bus stop, and the board has said that they won't leave kids behind. So it's a little unclear like how some of these things will work. But it'll be social distancing at school, masks required the whole time, and temperature screenings along with other sanitizers, breaks for hand washing, things like that.
So school officials have also set staggered return dates for sports teams. Swimming and diving would start next week, September 28th, along with basketball and cheerleading on September 30th. The following week, men's soccer and women's lacrosse. In the next week, October 12th, football returns with the possible return of marching band. I don't know why football can return, but marching band could not. Taking up the rear, men's tennis, men's and women's golf, women's soccer and softball, and men's and women's track and field and wrestling. Why this staggered approach?
That I don't know. I do not cover high school sports that closely. I would assume it's the same kind of thinking. If you bring all the sports back, it's hard to contact trace. And there's a lot of chaos, a lot of shared facilities. If you bring one sport back at a time, you have more control over that. Swimming and diving, the chlorine, I think it's also like thinking about, you know, like the kinds of sports we bring back. Like, I'm a swimmer. I can imagine socially distancing and swimming is a lot easier than in, like, wrestling.
But golf is coming back last, almost last. And golf is almost a lone sport. You could play it just with yourself. You don't have to have people standing around. So why are they waiting till the very end to come back? Why are even tennis? You could be playing with maybe one or two other people, but they're across the net.
It is not a perfectly linear trajectory. I will say that. I do not know the exact like sport X contact tracing formula that they went with, but I do think the staggered approach has something to do with, you know, it's easier than opening all the gates at once.
The city, David, has been concerned for years now about affordable housing and the dearth of affordable workforce housing, and they've taken steps to improve that housing. And yet a report came out this week, the annual State of Housing Instability and Homelessness report, that shows an increase in homelessness, and that despite years of public and private efforts, the number of affordable housing units continues its decline. Do they understand why? How can that be after all this money we've put into this?
Well, you know, the gap has been large, you know, tens of thousands of units, and it looks like that number is continuing to go up. The number of units that we're building in the last couple of years is in the single digit thousands. So, you know, we are getting at the problem, but it is not happening fast enough. At the same time, you know, lots of new apartment buildings are being built with luxury rents, and that is changing the percentage. One of the interesting statistics out of this is that the percentage of all rental units in Charlotte that are deemed to be affordable, rents under $800 a month, has fallen from 51% in 2010 to 25%. And that's a huge, that's half the percentage. And it just gives you a good picture of the trend and the kind of wave that is so hard to push back against. And again, some of this is being caused by, you know, the coronavirus right now. You know, we've the issue about the homeless population growing, that may be a factor in the fact that we have now 1,000 more homeless people than we did a year ago. It's such a complex problem. We have lots of people working on it, and they're all continuing to work on it in spite of numbers like this.
Are there recommendations in that report about what to do?
You know, it's the same things that we are doing, you know, continue to develop housing. But also one of the issues that they took up this year that they have not done in the past is looking at some of the structural barriers to affordable housing. And one of the issues that they're looking at is source of income discrimination, which means landlords who won't take vouchers or other housing subsidies, they'd rather wait around for somebody who has the personal income to cover that. And, you know, that is not illegal, but there are folks in Charlotte who are working right now to lobby the council to adopt rules to do that. So that's one potential solution. Some of the other reasons have to do with health and mental health issues, lack of income, and those are all structural problems that require much more than just a housing plan.
And yet there will be another edition of affordable housing bonds on the ballot on November the 3rd, another $50 million. Will that help, do you think, or do these, with this report? Because this report was based on 2018 census data. Things may have changed since then, but do you think that will help?
That will help, and we know from, there's also the private sector effort, which is another $50 million, and there are commitments by banks here to do more. All of that is helping to solve it piece by piece, you know, but $50 million is going to get us in the, you know, a few thousand units maybe, yeah. And it's just a problem that we have to keep chipping away at.
Wells Fargo CEO Charles Scharf this week found himself having to apologize for comments he made in a memo about the difficulty of finding qualified black executives. In that memo, he outlined a set of changes to improve Wells Fargo's diversity. He said that if he and other executives did not meet new goals and hire a more diverse workforce, their pay would be docked. But in the second bullet point, he wrote, while it might sound like an excuse, the unfortunate reality is that there is a very limited pool of black talent to recruit from with this specific experience, as our industry does not have enough diversity in most senior roles. That is that's true. That's why they want to improve diversity. So why, Mary, did he get in trouble for saying this? And I only have about 30 seconds left.
Well, first of all, it was an excuse. And second of all, it's just not true. That's what happens when you have the old boys network, when you go and look at the people you know and ask, look at his list. It's just people, his friends, his associates. You have to affirmatively expand the pool, and you will see that there are qualified, very people with great resumes. And it's up to you to do that because they are out there. But until you do, it will get locked out. Barack Obama wasn't the first black person qualified to be president. He was the first one that had an opportunity and that support. So yeah, he has to, as the leader, go out and expand his pool, and he will see the amount of talent that's out there. He should have apologized. He has to affirmatively do something.
Mary C. Curtis with the Roll Call, WCCB-TV, and now Roll Call's new Equal Time podcast, which started this week. Annie Ma, education reporter for the Charlotte Observer, Katie Peralta, senior editor with the Charlotte Agenda, and David Borax, reporter for WFAE News. Thank you all for the hour. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.